It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Reverend Eleanor Williams is the associate pastor at Church of Our Savior United Methodist Church in Northview Heights. She's one of the forces behind the Northside Partnership Project. For 32 years, she taught learning and emotional support students in Pittsburgh public schools, and she co-founded Parents Against Violence. Reverend Williams, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So it seems that you've lived your life as part of a larger cause. How would you define that cause? What drives you?
Passion, I could say. And just trying to make a difference in my own little corner of the world. You know, I've come to know that I can't save the whole world or even function in the whole world, but my own little corner of the world, I can try to do my best through my passion and just trying to make a difference in someone else's life.
I mentioned at the beginning the Northside Partnership Project, a collaboration of groups and organization. Who's involved in this project, and briefly, what is its intent?
Well, you know, we're a group of grassroots organizations that came together because we had the same forcing drive to help children, parents, you know, just families in general. And so we said, you know what? We had a school that was up for sale. It was available. We were hoping for the community. So then we said, well, let's get together and try to purchase a school to do the things that we were doing. We can do it all together in one setting. Mm-hmm. Because we were just grassroots organizations that, you know, our offices were in the coffee shops and in our homes,
right,
and wherever we can find a table. And so we came together to try to do what we do for the community.
We want to bring things together. You said you were here and there, the different organizations. But what are some of the services that you want to provide that the community needs?
Yeah, we want to bring what we call our STEAM program. You know, we added the A on the STEM and made it arts because it's such a lost cause. And so we come together to do our STEAM program, which, you know, kind of drives the things that we're doing, skill training, you know, expose the community and families to different arenas and job training, job development. And that's our focus, you know, just to get people exposed and to different things that'll make them become more confident, self-sufficient, economic development. Yeah.
Is it a place also for the community to come together to meet and share some of the ideas that you were talking about earlier?
Oh, sure. We have an open door policy. We have also on the other flip side of that, we have spaces that we lease out to different social services and community groups. For instance, we have a Northside Athletic Association who works with the little peewee football teams.
Uh-huh.
And so they work out of that school because, you know, after football's over and winter comes, there's nothing still left for the kids to do too much. So now they're all year round. They can come into school, they can do some conditioning and training and different things like that. We have a studio where people can come in, you know, the young adults, they like to record and, you know.
We have a recording studio.
We have a recording studio. We have videography. And we have also what we're starting is a community barbershop for barbers to come in and they're able to get a discounted price on their chairs, you know, for beginners who are really trying to establish themselves. So we're doing a lot for the community. They come in, they're there all the time. We have aerobics classes, dance classes.
A key aspiration for community is feeling safe, feeling secure. You co-founded Parents Against Violence in 1993 in response to a rise in street violence in Pittsburgh. Have you seen any progress toward reducing violence, enhancing residents' feeling of security, safety through the years?
I think the more we educate our children and the more we educate them and the more we get involved in their life, I think that might eliminate some of the violence that goes on. We did a great job when we first started out bringing the gangs together, having them make a truce, educating them on life and what, you know, and how important things are. So it's more of an individual thing that you have to focus on the children that you know and really try to educate them on life issues and situations, which would make it, you know, more safe for the community.
Are parents as actively involved today as they might have been when you started the organization?
I think they are. Some, you know, people want to do, but they don't know what to do. And I think people and all of are really wanting to know, what can I do to make a difference? But our younger generation of young mothers, just like the Bible tells us, we older women should educate the younger women.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is the Reverend Eleanor Williams, one of the leaders of the Northside Partnership Project. Another important part of your career, maybe I ought to say your life, was teaching, learning, and emotional support students in Pittsburgh Public Schools for more than three decades. Knowing what you know now, what are some of the practical ways for schools to better serve and support children with learning and emotional challenges, would you say?
Love. It's very important that the children get the attention and the love that they need, because sometimes school is the only place where they are in a community where they may feel safe or where they may get a hug, you know, even a meal. Mm-hmm. So I think that as long as we keep that personal touch with children, I think that that would make a difference in their life.
Personal touch. So any advice for parents of these kids?
Attention, giving your children attention and, you know, loving on them and letting them know that they are, you know, they are someone, that they can strive and be whatever they, you know, desire.
You're a teacher, a minister, served in several churches. You work on projects to better the community. So in preparing for our little talk here, I found out that you're a poet as well. Your writing has been published in a couple of anthologies. So all of your work that we've been talking about, to me, I think it's directed outward, helping people. What about the writing and the poetry? Is that sort of directed internally to maybe for your own benefit, you know, your own, you know, feeling good about yourself?
Yeah, it is. It was really, I thought, a secret.
Not anymore.
But it is something that I do for my own internal self. I started out just writing journals. Mm-hmm. And I did projects for the University of Pittsburgh Young Writers Program. For years, I worked with them, summer programs for the youth and writing and different genres. I went to a class first, originally, with the University of Pittsburgh to get techniques and follow up on, you know, different types of writing. So then I worked in a summer program for them for, you know, familiarizing children with different genres of writing. Right. And then that's when I found that my love for writing was poetry. Mm. And so I started writing, you know, poetry and was enjoying it. Just, you know, it was relaxing to me and got off some ideas in my head that, you know, in a way that was not offensive, but venting, instead of a vent.
Sometimes we need that that little safety valve, don't
right,
we?
Right.
So now that it's no longer a secret, would you care to read one of your poems for us? And what might it be?
I think I would probably enjoy reading one that I like, that it's called Escape.
All right.
And what influenced me to read this was talking about the young people and trying to let them know that, you know, there is a way out and you just have to stay focused and do what you need to do to progress in your life.
Okay.
So I'll read this one. It's called Escape. Trying to escape from what, to where, and why. Trying to escape from oneself, anxious, nervous, lonely. Trying to escape what may be around the corner. Trying to escape the footsteps, heavy, clanking, from tips missing on heels. Trying to escape the long wait after the storm is done to hear the voice of inexperience hiding in you to hide themselves, anxious, nervous, lonely. Your wings have been clipped, but we try to keep them tied down. The span is greater than a condor, ready to sweep away life from what is not real, leaving it stagnant with loads of fear and confusion, thirsting to hear what is true, only to run with it and fall, crawl. Trying to escape from what might be waiting, trying to escape not to hate where you are going, trying to escape to win the battle that others think is so hard because it is hard for them. Trying to escape the reality that no one understands, so they hold you down by your wings, stopping you from leaving them senseless, dumb, ignorant to what isn't real anyway. Make haste. Time is running past you. It is no longer seems forever, but forever is right now. Wiggle away from the hold of your wings and fly into the life set for you, leaving them with feathers, wondering how to stop the pain in their eyes as you soar into your destiny. Escape.
Reverend Eleanor Williams is the associate pastor at Church of Our Savior, United Methodist Church in Northview Heights, a longtime teacher of special needs students, one of the forces behind the Northside Partnership Project, and a poet. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Symphony Society debuts for the first time at Syria Mosque in Oakland in 1926. 90 musicians performed under conductor Richard Hageman and concertmaster Elias Breeskin. The group had existed previously under the moniker Pittsburgh Orchestra, but had taken a hiatus due to financial difficulties. Their 1926 concert included pieces by Wagner and Tchaikovsky. The next year, the Symphony Society organized a weekly performance series, which became popular among Pittsburgh residents. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's air quality made headlines last week when the American Lung Association released its annual report listing the region among the top 10 most polluted cities in the country. But some researchers say the report doesn't tell the whole story. 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed talked with Carnegie Mellon University professor Alan Robinson to try to get a more nuanced view of local air quality.
The American Lung Association report looks at a pretty big region. It reaches from Butler and Lawrence County into Ohio and West Virginia over to Indiana, Westmoreland, and Fayette counties. So when the region gets a failing grade, how accurate is that assessment?
I think what you're getting at is how representative that value is. And so the design value for Allegheny County, that's what's used to designate whether or not our air is healthy or not, whether or not we're in compliance with the national regulations, is the worst monitor in the area. And that's downwind of the Clare & Coke facility, which is a very large industrial facility, and the air quality there is substantially worse than other areas in the county. And so how representative is that of the exposure that I get, you know, living, you know, in Point Breeze? At times the winds are coming from Clare, and you can smell the air pollution in the city. I'll ride my bike into work and I can definitely smell the air pollution. But, you know, that's on a minority of days. And that's, you know, that's because Clareton has a big impact on air quality, but it's not determining the air quality in Pittsburgh.
So would you say that over time our air quality is actually improving?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's dramatically improved. I mean, when I first moved here, levels were 17 or something was the average in Pittsburgh, and now it's about 9.
What are these numbers?
So it's a concentration of pollutant in the air. So it's measured in units of micrograms per meter cubed. And the current standard, when I first moved to Pittsburgh, the standard was 15 and micrograms per meter cubed annual average. And then based on new evidence, the standard got revised down to 12, and I don't remember exactly when that happened, but sometime in the last 20 years it was down to 12. But when I first moved to Pittsburgh, say you went to the county health department in Lawrenceville, on their campus there, they have a monitor on their roof, you know, it was probably reading 16 or 17 micrograms per meter cubed. So it was violating the older, less stringent standard, and now that monitor reads about 9. So in 2 decades, I don't think we haven't halved the pollution levels, but almost have the pollution levels. And that's been accomplished through cleaner cars, stricter controls on power plants, a lot of regulations that the county put on local sources. And the benefits of that are lives saved. I mean, nationally, 100,000 lives are saved each year associated with the cleaner air. So that's a real benefit. So I think there's a big success story. So this is sort of the half full view of the world. Then the half empty view of the world is that there's still a big public health burden associated with air pollution. And as a society, we have to decide whether or not those adverse health effects are acceptable.
So can you tell me about the work that you're doing here at CMU to give a more nuanced view of air quality?
Yeah, so we do a number of different things. And we're very interested in the spatial distribution of air pollution. You know, how do the pollution levels in Shadyside compared to the Hill District compared to top of Mount Washington? So we have instrumented vehicles that we drive around, and you literally drive every road, in the city, and you do that a whole bunch of times, and you can get a very detailed map of what the pollution concentrations are in the city. And so you can find out what neighborhoods have higher concentrations, what neighborhoods have lower concentrations. You can start to understand why. So that's one way that we're doing it, is by driving around. And then the other way is we actually have a network that we're running in Pittsburgh of sensors. And I think the peak has been sort of 70-some-odd locations. And you definitely find, spatial patterns. I mean, one of the things that we've found is levels near freeways are not as high as you might think. I mean, so that's like a good news story. But in terms of other sources, certainly like the South Side, actually the pollution level is pretty high. And that's because there's a lot of restaurants and those types of things.
Dr. Robinson, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for listening.
That was CMU air quality researcher Alan Robinson talking with 90.5 WESA's Liz Reed. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For the city to pull off a weekend-long 26.2-mile party, a lot of public safety officials have to come together, city and county and state police, plus EMS, fire, and other neighboring agencies join forces to close roads and support runners and spectators alike. Chris Tonieri is the public information officer for the Pittsburgh Public Safety Department. Ahead of the marathon this weekend, he spoke to the Confluence's Megan Harris about what it takes to get first responders ready for race day.
A little nitty gritty. One of the first things the public sees is those street closures, which of course begin just hours before many of these races. But when does the planning start on your end from law enforcement?
The process is a lengthy one, and there are months and months of preparations, and it's not just in the city of Pittsburgh. There are a lot of agencies outside of the city that contribute. It's a real team effort. The course has been established for a few years at this point. Every year there is tinkering, but in terms of sending out notifications and letting people know that roads will be closed, those efforts begin months in advance.
How many officers and civilians within the law enforcement community are ultimately on the streets?
I don't have that number handy. There are many officers who are out there. To make sure that, you've trained 5-6 months to run a race, and we want the event to be something that you remember for the race and nothing else.
What sort of situations then do law enforcement usually address during the marathon itself?
So when you have people running as many as 26.2 miles, obviously EMS and firefighters and police play an important role in just runner safety. So they're spread throughout the course. There are first responders who are there keeping an eye on runners and making sure that if anyone needs medical attention, they're going to get it quickly.
The marathon, of course, takes place all at once, all across the city for a few hours a year. Would you say there is anything comparable that officers regularly participate in?
No. No, it's different because it's spread out and it's mobile. And it's not like an event that is just at the point or an event that is just on the North Shore or even a parade that stretches a mile or so through downtown. The regatta or, you know, a Steeler game. This is unique in that it covers quite literally 26.2 miles of the city.
How do you keep eyes on all 26.2 miles plus all the little pockets of activity along the route?
So public safety does have an event operations center that is located downtown. And there, in that room, there are officials from every law enforcement agency and every public safety department that is watching and making sure that everything is okay and making sure that, you know, if there are any areas of concern, they're addressing it immediately. It's real time.
What is that like from the law enforcement perspective? Is there excitement?
Sure, there's excitement. We have an event with 40,000 people, 40,000 runners, thousands of people in neighborhoods who are coming out to support the runners. This is a huge celebration. So there is a lot of excitement, but there's also a lot of planning that goes into it. And it's sort of like an umpire at a baseball game. Public safety does a great job if nobody notices that they did anything.
Would you say that officers and staff enjoy the race in the same way that others maybe get to?
Not quite, because it can be similar. Because for runners and for public safety, it is months of preparation, which culminates in a single day, a single event. It's a little bit different, though, when it's over, public safety doesn't get a medal around their neck and a banana and a Gatorade. So it's a little bit different. But
they could
sure,
probably grab one if they wanted one.
They probably could, but we want to save those for the runners.
So what about you? You've got a pretty unique vantage point. You used to cover the race as a journalist. You freelanced for P3R, the marathon's organizing body, as a program writer. Now you're in law enforcement and you've ran it. Twice you've done all 26.2 miles plus four or five efforts at the half. Do you still look forward to the marathon now that you're on the other side?
I do. I love it. I wish I was running it because it is the greatest marathon. I've run marathons in five different cities. Pittsburgh is my favorite marathon. It's so much fun to run through the neighborhoods. Every single neighborhood is different. I have memories from, snapshots from rounding corners in the West End to running down Frankstown in Homewood, and a woman in a purple robe banging on a pot with a wooden spoon and calling me out by name because it was on my bib, to running through Bloomfield at the end. And, the support that you get there, it's so much fun to be a part of it. So I do wish that I was participating as a runner. On the other hand, as a member of public safety, I get to see all of the work that people like Director Wendell Hisrick and Commander Ed Trapp put in to make this happen. And my personal favorite thing as a member of public safety is to be at the finish line. Because Police Chief Scott Schubert stands there at the finish line. Doesn't matter if it's raining, if it's hot, it doesn't matter. He just stands there at the finish line and high fives everyone who comes over. People who have run 26.2 miles and are exhausted, then they suddenly look up because they finished. And there's the police chief giving him a high five and say, great job. And it's a lot of fun to witness that. There's a lot of unity. So I love this event, and I've loved it from every connection that I've had to it.
And you're participating in your own way with your son this year, I understand?
Yes, this will be my first kids marathon.
Chris Tanieri is the public information officer for the Pittsburgh Public Safety Department. Chris, thanks so much and good luck out there this weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. May Day, May 1st, means different things in different parts of the world. From a day to acknowledge workers' rights and advocate for justice for all workers to a time to celebrate spring. We're going to talk about how May Day is celebrated in the Pittsburgh area with Christina Acuna Castillo, digital organizer and artist with Pittsburgh United, who has helped organize the march later this evening. Caleb Gamble, musician and house painter, who's participating in that May Day march, and Guillermo Perez, president of the Pittsburgh Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Thanks to all of you for coming in and joining us today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
So I want to start with, what does May Day mean to you? Guillermo, we're going to start with you.
Well, May Day now means for me the day that worker and immigrant rights are the focus of everything we do as activists here in Pittsburgh. It's our day. We have a huge Labor Day here in Pittsburgh, but International Workers' Day is the day, is really the world's Labor Day. And for the work that LACLA does, our focus is on advocating for Latino immigrants here. And since the huge demonstrations back in 2006 around an anti-immigration bill that was had passed the House, we had demonstrations all over the country. And that really married the traditional International Workers' Day to the cause of immigrants and immigrant rights. And for us, it's all about labor rights. It's all the same thing for us, for my organization.
Caleb, what's May Day mean to you?
I think it's an opportunity to both celebrate all of the struggle and hard work that people have done to create working conditions for themselves all across the world with dignity and in solidarity, as well as spring. It's a time to celebrate spring as well, and I feel like those both belong together. They're both like times to look around and acknowledge what's new, what's fresh, and where the real growth is, and how to live our lives in that way.
May Day, I think for me, serves as a reminder that like our work is interconnected and our liberation is too. And so that day for me is like worker justice and dignity for all workers, but also for immigrants, and like making sure that those two narratives and movements are always interconnected, so that way we can achieve that liberation in our lifetime, right? Because a lot of people deserve it.
There are several events taking place this week and next to mark May Day, including a march this evening. How much do those events focus on the very serious idea of advocacy being done to promote workers' rights, and how much is it a celebration?
Well, I would say it's both, without a doubt. We want to celebrate all working people, and most especially undocumented working people from LACLA's perspective. But as Caleb said, you know, it is the start of spring. It is a time of renewal. And for those of us in the labor movement, it's also generally the time when we take to the streets. And there are a lot of important campaigns going on right now around union organizing and labor rights and immigrant rights. So for us, this is sort of like kick off the season for taking to the streets and advocating for workers.
There aren't two separate things.
Right.
For me, they're very interconnected. And to celebrate in the street doesn't necessarily, it's not like a bad thing. And actually, like a lot of communities deserve to celebrate, and they deserve to take a day to uplift their communities and their humanity. And that's, you know, that's a form of protest as well.
Anytime people come together in the street to celebrate their lives as working people across their immediate community and come together to empower each other and just celebrate what it takes to survive, that's really meaningful, and that's what it's all about. And everybody needs something different to get free, and we also need each other to do that.
Mm-hmm. For those who haven't participated in past May Day events, how would you describe them? Caleb, let's start with you on that one.
It's very earnest and very sincere. For me, because it takes place during the spring, there's this opening up, and you see people you haven't seen all year. And also, this is something that's very tied up in current struggle and current loss and current movement, and so it's always reflective of what's going on in our life right now and in our city.
Very participatory, would you say?
Yes, incredibly participatory.
Christina, who are these events for? What kind of stories are you trying to tell through the involvement of different groups in the various May Day events?
I mean, for me, from my perspective, the march is for workers who feel undervalued and underrecognized, and it's a day to like to say to them, I see you, and we're in this together. And you know, like, the only way that we are going to get free and win together is if we recognize each other's humanities, if we come together to say that our work is valuable, and also we're more than our work. And so in order to like be in solidarity with each other, we have to recognize both things as true.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, like, this march is I think it reminds me, if we're talking about an audience, I think it reminds me mostly of my mom's experience of May Day last year when she came. It was her first May Day in the United States for the entire time that she's been in this country.
So what was that experience like for her?
Well, yeah, last May Day, she was still undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been trying to get her citizenship for the last 25 years. And sometime after May Day, she finally got her citizenship. But for May Day, you know, I think after we left the march, she was like, wow, you all had a housekeeper speak. And that was me, you know, like she saw herself in the speakers. She felt herself, you know, in the movement in the songs. And so like walking down the streets and sort of like not feeling like she has to run or hide or like, mm-hmm. you know, duck her head or feel invisible. Was a powerful thing for her, and I think, you know, for my grandma as well, and like other folks who were in similar positions.
Well, let me follow up on that. Yeah. Of course, May Day is celebrated around the world. How did the celebration here in the U.S. compare to what maybe she saw elsewhere prior to coming here?
So my family is from Peru. Peru has a big May Day celebration as well. The atmosphere and like environment that mm-hmm. is over there, at least in our country, Peru, it does feel like unified, very like, you know, in this together. And I think in this country, she was very like nervous and like sort of confused about where her position is. But then I think after the march, she realized that like she is a part of the movement moving forward and like she's always been. And I think that was like a really good reminder for her.
We want the immigrant community here most especially to feel safe and secure and to come out and to demand their rights and to demand mm-hmm. dignity. And so I think May Day is more important than ever mm-hmm. given the climate that we're dealing with. And most especially, we're doing this in Squirrel Hill for a reason. We're showing our solidarity with the Jewish community of Squirrel Hill for the horrible hate crime that was committed there. And again, you know, that was a product of xenophobia, of racism, of anti-Semitism. And those are worker issues, too, that, you know, that we want to highlight here and say, you know, that it's not acceptable in Pittsburgh.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Today is May Day, May 1st. We're talking about how we're marking the event and the movement here in Pittsburgh this year. And we're talking with Christina Acuna Castillo, Caleb Gamble, and Guillermo Perez. How do you think the local efforts fit into the national conversation about May Day and workers' rights?
I can speak as someone who works for the United Steelworkers. Our perspective is that we live in a global economy, and that unions increasingly have to be global. Our objective is to build a union of the Americas, and so I think International Workers' Day. We're bringing a bunch of steelworkers from Canada to this march, and for them, this is something they do every year. And so, you know, it's very much unions today in this atmosphere have to be thinking about developing relationships internationally. And so we'll have, you know, that'll be part of what's going on at the march, is we're going to have a number of people from other parts of the world, I mean, literally visiting to march that mm-hmm. evening.
Caleb, why do you participate?
I see it as an opportunity, I guess, because May Day is such a broad celebration. And myself as an individual, I see the people around me finding ways to make beauty in their life as working people in so many dynamic ways. And as it's tied into other celebrations that occur in North America and all over the world that I've seen, it's just this really incredible intersectional moment of art and politics and solidarity, unlike anything I've ever experienced. Mm-hmm. And I just see that as incredibly fruitful, mm-hmm. I guess, artistically. And like a lot of good friends I've made are because of May Day. Mm-hmm.
As people engaged in workers' rights advocacy year-round, are you glad to have people recognize your cause, your efforts, however they feel moved to do so, you know, how they want to get involved? So, Christine, let's start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most important parts for me for May Day is making sure that everyone feels a part of the movement and a part, you know, after May 1st, especially a part of the work to fight for dignity and justice and joy for all working people beyond borders, mm-hmm. right? And so for me, The march this year is about solidarity, but it's also about, I don't know, like recognizing that we are more than our work, and that like in order to get free together, we need to to recognize that our work is valuable, and we are also, like, we're people and we're more than our work. And so the solidarity sort of theme of this year, I think for me, like, is important in the way that it brings different perspectives together, in the way that it brings different immigrant communities together to stand against, you know, the things that are killing us, especially in Squirrel Hill. And so, yeah, for me, it's a way everyone can get plugged in, especially moving forward.
Yeah, it's definitely an opportunity every year to have people meet up who haven't met each other and haven't organized together, and to start doing that and start working together in every way possible, from small to large. That's what it's about.
Guillermo.
I think it's worth remembering the original May Day. 1886 was a product of a movement for an eight-hour day, right? And really the central theme to this was we need to have lives apart from work. We need to have time,
right?
To be part of a community, to be with our families.
That's right.
To celebrate our lives, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so May Day really means that as well. And it is a, you know, it's a labor struggle, especially now, for people who are having to work incredibly long hours under very difficult conditions and just struggling to have time with your family, just struggling to have some kind of dignity on the job.
Final question for you all. There are lots of events from May 1st into next week. Just curious, what are you each looking most forward to over the next several days? Christina, we'll start with you. Go around the table.
So Petanque Tonk is like a music festival, and also a space where community organizations come and learn from each other, and sort of like it brings thousands of people together to experience music that goes beyond borders and to engage in work and conversations that go beyond the music festival. So this year, there's a few of us who will be performing at the concert, along with some youth that we've been working for like the last 6 months.
You said a few of us, that implies you.
that implies me and Caleb. We've been working really hard these last 6 months to gather kids together in this like music program that also involves a lot of healing work. We bring kids together, youth of color, who have experienced, you know, ICE immigration take their fathers away from them. We have families who come from continents that they've had to flee because of white supremacy, and so we bring all these kids together to say, you know, our pain is interconnected and our hurt is connected and it's the same thing, but also like moving forward, our healing and our joy can be together too if both things can be true.
Okay.
So I'm really excited about that.
Caleb?
Just visibility in general. It's to see all of the people and these events grow and they become more dynamic and larger, to get a chance to see all the different people of the city coming out in these different ways and celebrating everything that there is to celebrate and honor.
We've got just a ton of work ahead of us. I'm looking forward to being in the street. I'm looking forward to helping people organize their union, to get to the bargaining table, and to start addressing frankly, substandard pay and working conditions. And there's a lot of work to be done on that. So May Day's going to be, hopefully, energizes us for this, for the fights ahead.
Guillermo Perez is the president of the Pittsburgh Labor Council for Latin American Advancement. Caleb Gamble is participating in this week's May Day events. And Christina Acuna Castillo is a digital organizer and artist with Pittsburgh United. Thanks so much, and very happy May Day to all of you.
Oh, same to you.
Yeah, thank you.
And for today, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, since joining NPR in 1986, Don Gagne has reported on the auto industry, has served as White House correspondent during 9/11, and now he's a national political correspondent. A conversation with Don Gagne about labor, the White House, and politics. An Ascent expert has developed a new kit to help locate missing persons. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovic and Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.